Welcome, Earthlings, to the Sirens of Audio podcast. I am The Voice. And tonight, Dwayne and Philip are joined by Mark from Prague 2.
Sorry, I'm just going to charge it for my computer's about to run out of battery. Sorry.
I thought I was going to have to call an ambulance or something.
Just disappeared out of shot. Sorry.
I could see your body moving. I thought, is he having a fit or something? Now I know why he left podcasting. Can't cope with it. G'day audiophiles, this is the Sirens of Audio, the show that explores the universe of Doctor Who in the audio medium. I'm Dwayne.
And I'm Philip. G'day audiophiles, g'day Dwayne.
And joining us is a very, very special guest from, well, he's the originator of the podcast Prog to Who. It's Mark Atkinson. Welcome.
Hello, good evening and good morning, whatever it is, wherever we are.
Welcome,
nice to meet you guys.
Oh, how good is it to hear your voice on the podcast feeds again? It's been far too long.
No, cheers, Dwayne. Thank you. It's nice to be asked.
Well, I'll tell you a bit about that in a second, but I'll just let everyone know that we are going to be discussing a couple of stories that was picked by the Big Finish Randomoid Selectatron in a segment or an episode that we like to call...
We've Got Randomoids.
Yes, that's right. It's Randomoids time, and we are going to be talking about medicinal purposes, main range story number 60, and the other story we're going to discuss is main range story number 201, We Are the Daleks. So looking forward to that. Now, Mark, since I've got you here, I want to talk to you about, just for a minute, about Proctor Who and how important it was for me. I don't know if I've told you this. I probably have at some point, but what have I mentioned?
Well, I mentioned that you used to listen to it and inspired you in a way to do your own podcast.
Oh, so I keep banging on about the same thing over and over again, do I? All right. Well, it's true.
No, that's good, though.
Because you actually got me into Doctor Who podcasts, because we actually met not through Doctor Who. We met through your band Riversea. I was interviewing you on my radio show about Riversea's first album that came out 10 years ago now, maybe longer.
2012. Yeah.
Yeah. And we got to know each other on Facebook, and you just happened to notice that I was a Doctor Who fan, or I noticed you were one. I think you were dressed in your Tom Baker gear, weren't you? Your fourth Doctor gear.
That was a dead giveaway, isn't it?
Yeah, bit of a giveaway. Yeah. And you mentioned to me that you were starting up this new podcast. It was starting off with the first series of Capaldi called Prog to Who. And I was listening from the start. And I listened all the way through to every episode. And I was very disappointed when you left the first time, very disappointed when you left the second time. I'm just waiting for you to come back for the third time now. But, yeah, I've had many, many hours of laughs and good fun with you guys. And it was actually you and another podcast that I listened to religiously that inspired me to start the Sirens of Audio. So, Philip, you've got Mark to thank as well.
Mark to thank or Mark to blame?
Blame, I guess.
Excellent. No, that's nice. Thanks, Dwayne. Yeah, no, it's great. I'm glad you enjoyed it. I mean, we certainly had fun doing it. It was great fun. I loved it.
Lots and lots of laughs. I always laugh at Craig's mispronunciation of every name and you trying to correct him. And I hear your voice coming underneath correcting him, but he just doesn't hear. It's like all these... idiosyncratic personality traits from you guys. You're all classics. Yeah. Love yous.
That was a nice combo. It came together exactly how I imagined it, actually, because I'd met Craig and he came to a gig of mine in Whitby, and he got introduced to me. And anyway, we started talking about Doctor Who straight away. And I just, at that moment, I thought, if I ever do a podcast, this is the guy to get on. And exactly the same with Bob. Whenever I'd see him at gigs, with the brief time we had together, we'd always be talking about Doctor Who. And I thought, and I know the other guy, and it'll be Bob. And then I thought, and it'd be great to play music. Anyway, I had this idea for months, and then it finally happened, and the show turned out exactly how I always wanted it to as well, which was great, you know. So, no, I'm pleased. Yeah, mate, rest in peace.
Yeah, it did regenerate into around the console, so the guys move on after you left the last time, and they're still going, so you can still hear all their voices around the console, so that's pretty cool.
No, it's great, yeah.
So yeah, I just wanted to say thank you, Mark. It's because of you that we are here. So it's your fault.
Thanks, Sven. Your fault. Lovely. Thank you.
All right, we're going to get to these stories, but before we do, do you know what, Philip?
What, Dwayne?
We're going to jump down the rabbit hole. Let's go. Righto, in the rabbit hole. Since we've got a musician with us, Mark, I thought I'd talk about a musical topic. And I want to talk about music and sound design in Doctor Who, maybe when it's worked and when it hasn't. You can talk about the TV series, or you can talk about audios as well, because I know you don't listen to every single Big Finish, but I know you've been listening to them in the early years especially, hadn't you?
Yeah, well, I listened right from the beginning in 1999. I remember getting the sounds the Sounds of Time on cassette, actually. I updated to CD later. But yeah, I got everything pretty much, right? All the main range and lots of the spin-offs, right until we went into lockdown. And then I had to stop because I had no more money. My money had suddenly stopped overnight. So yeah, I stopped buying them then. And since then, I've not bought again. Simply because I've not had enough money, and also because I've got so much of the back catalogue, I'm just re-listening to stuff and enjoying re-listening to it, you know. So
yeah. So as a musical and sound production professional, what was your opinion of their production at the time? Their production values.
Well, it's always been amazing, hasn't it? I've just re-listened to Phantasmagoria, I think it's called. Yeah, the second ever release, the first full one with Peter Davison, and noticed how that just still sounded amazing as well. The productions has been there from the beginning, really. The standard of the production, incredible. I never ever listen to a Big Finish and think, oh, that music's really bad, or anything like that. It never stands out as being bad. Not like in the way that, you know, some of the TV series do, especially the late 80s ones, where, you know, the music comes in and think, oh my god, that's awful. There's nothing like that in Big Finish. I think it's pretty consistently good throughout, without being mind-blowing, but it takes you there. I think they do an amazing job in every direction. Yeah.
It's interesting, the late 80s music, isn't it, with those three or four different composers. You've got a very distinct styles with Dominic Glynn, Mark Ayres, Kef McCulloch. And they sort of had a different style. So sometimes in those stories it worked. Sometimes, I guess, it was a bit too much, I guess. And
so the time, isn't it? I mean, that's the thing. Each music, I mean, look at the Sea Devils music. I mean, blimey, that is absolutely crazy, isn't it? But is it of the time? And it is same with the late 80s stuff with drum machines coming in, and it's all, you know, very sort of glitzy. And that it's of the 80s, isn't it? I mean, and I think I don't really notice the music that much until it's either really bad or really good. Do you know what I mean? I was, you know, you can obviously, you know, when it's just not working, there's something that just, you know, stands out in that way. But when it's beautiful, I often comment to Tam when we're watching something, the music really is gorgeous on that certain scene. That music's amazing. It really leaps out. Do you know what I mean? But the best sort of music, I suppose, or not the best, but the stuff that Big Finish are great at, is that music that just creates the moods that you need underneath what's going on. You know, so yeah, it's a whole new talent, isn't it? I wouldn't know where to begin to write to score, to be honest. I'm not that sort of songwriter. You know, I'm a songwriter, not a score writer as such. But they do an amazing job, and the Big Finish guys do as well. Incredible.
Are you more of a melodic kind of music guy, or prefer the atmospheric layering type of guy?
It depends, really. It's light and shade, and I mean, it's like my music, my taste is very eclectic. It's all over the place. I love everything from the really, like Metallica and Black Sabbath and all the really hard rock, to the really gentle stuff and classical stuff and really gentle acoustic stuff and everything in between, really. There's not much I don't like, apart from maybe rapping and dubstep or whatever, and Oasis. But apart from that, I like sort of pretty much everything, really, you know, to varying degrees, but yeah.
I was thinking about you today, Philip, because I was thinking about season 25 for some reason. And I always wondered why you like Silver Nemesis so much. And it's because there's a saxophone theme going throughout that story. That's why you like it, isn't it?
That's certainly one of the reasons why I like it. I'm a tenor saxophone player, and I must admit, the one thing that is still on my bucket list to do is play Bolero with a symphony orchestra, because it's one of the very few symphonic works that actually has a saxophone, tenor saxophone, as part of the score. But that's a different matter. In terms of Doctor Who scores, it's interesting. I mean, the 60s was very much recorded before the show was made. It had to be played in the studio. So it's a very different technique that was being used by Dudley Simpson then as opposed to later on. So I think a lot of that melody stuff you don't get, and of course you don't get much theme music at all in the early shows because it was just too expensive. So if you picked up 4 or 5 minutes at all in an episode, you've done quite well. I think some scores work really well. I'm a melody person. I love late leitmotifs. I love character tunes and themes. So I think Murray Gold, to me, in terms of TV series, when he came on board, I loved him. And still do. I mean, I will listen to his albums all the time. So I regularly put on, particularly the season 1-2 album, the first CD that came out. It's got so many great themes. I mean, there's stuff in The Five Doctors I love. The main stuff, the Cybermen attacks and stuff, I think is amazing scores. And in terms of Big Finish, I think, as Mark said, when a score is working well, you don't notice it. And so there's lots of times I get the end of a Big Finish score and I haven't really noticed it. But in scores that need a bit of emotion, the music can play such an important part in terms of turning up, dialing up the emotion. But I mean, as I said, different directors use different things. I mean, Lisa Bowerman deliberately uses hardly any music at all because her view is that the emotion should be created by the characters, whereas other directors will want to use a lot more music. Yeah. It's an important, essential part, which, as Mark said, when it's working well, you either don't notice it at all or it makes you cry. But when it's bad, it's awful.
I must say I'm a bit more of a minimalist when it comes to music in audio drama. I struggle a little bit with really busy noises when it comes to action stories. They have to be done really, really well. And there are some action Big Finishes out there that are just top notch. But I often have to, I struggle a bit more with the density of the sounds in action stories. So I like a bit more of the talky stuff, which is good for the stories that we're going to discuss today.
There's some amazing theme songs. I mean, to me, I'd love an album of all their theme songs because the different themes are spectacular for all the different ranges.
Do you mean the theme itself?
Yeah, the actual themes for the different ranges that they have. No. I mean, not Doctor Who theme. That can come. I like the arrangements, but for their special sets, the Missy Box sets or the Unit or they're spectacular and really when you start pulling them apart. I mean, the fact that the Unit theme actually has Unit in Morse code tapped out by the instruments.
Oh, really?
Yeah, that bizarre rhythm that's happening in the background of the Unit theme is Unit being tapped out in Morse code.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's some amazing stuff that the composers have put into their themes.
Yep. Excellent. Definitely. All right. Well, let's leave that rabbit hole topic. Let's scramble up over the edge and we'll get back into the meat of our episode, which is two stories. We'll start off with Medicinal Purposes, which is the earlier story in the monthly range. And I'll read a blurb, shall I?
Definitely.
The blurb reads, Edinburgh, 1827. The infamous body snatchers William Burke and William Hare are at large. The local prostitutes dull their fear with cheap whiskey. The graveyard owls are hooting. Business is good. When accidental tourists, the Doctor and Evelyn Smythe, stumble upon one of Britain's most lurid, illuminating chapters in history, a simple case of interest in the work of a dedicated man of science, Dr. Robert Knox, quickly turns sour. Just what is that time-bending Scots mist? Whatever it is, may put the very fabric of the universe under threat. As always, here's a trailer.
Doctor Who, Medicinal Purposes.
No one can shout, no one can shout, no one can shout when the doctor's about.
One little drop or maybe two of a night can't do you any harm. Keeps the cold out. This fog gets into your bones and there's nothing you can do about it. Nothing at all. Apart from take a little drop or two of a night. Just a little drop or two. Oh, you startled me, gents. Oh, it's you two. A cold night for a stroll, isn't it?
Have you forgotten your British folklore?
Obviously.
Daft Jamie, ladies of easy virtue, blood on the streets. It can only add up to one thing.
Yes.
Body snatching.
There's a stranger in town.
Indeed.
He's snooping.
Snooping? How, man?
He saw the blood.
He saw blood.
Doctor, you talk about Burke and Hare as though you're looking forward to meeting them.
Exactly.
But they're criminals.
Undoubtedly.
Murderers.
Absolutely. But maybe not yet.
So a stranger saw the blood you two left behind. So what? If he hangs around for a bit longer, he may see a downside more.
You two are such gentlemen. It must be a long time since anyone said that about you two. Good night to you both.
I don't think so.
You want to do business at this hour?
That could be one way of putting it, yes.
No one can shout, no one can shout, no one can shout when the doctor's on the phone. No one can shout, no one can shout, no one...
Stop shouting, the doctor won't like you if you shout. Capital. Don't you think so, Hare?
I could have done with a bit more screaming myself. You know how much I like it, sir.
More blood, Mary. Why more blood, Mary? Mary! Mary!
Righto, Philip, are you ready? You wanted this. I told you to be ready. Give
I'm
us
ready.
Some quick facts about the story.
This is medicinal purposes, the facts and the trivia. So written by Robert Ross, and this is the first of three stories he would write for Big Finish. It's number 60 in the monthly range and recorded on the 18th and 19th of March 2004, released in August 2004. Stars Colin Baker and the late, great Maggie Sables. Also starring Leslie Phillips, who passed away on the 7th of November 2022 at 98, and a young and up-and-coming actor called David Tennant as Daft Jamie. Directed by Gary Russell, executive producer was Jacqueline Rayner, and the sound designer and music was by David Darlington. This story is actually based on historic events. The Burke and Hare murders was a series of 16 killings committed over a period of about 10 months in 1828 in Edinburgh, Scotland. They were undertaken by William Burke and William Hare, who sold the corpses to Robert Knox for dissection at his anatomy lectures. Edinburgh was the leading European centre for anatomical study in the early 19th century. That's the facts of the trivia of medicinal purposes.
Yay. Okay, so the thing that stands out for me, or stood out for me at the time, was the trailer. I thought this was one of the creepiest trailers I'd ever heard from Big Finish. We were talking about trailers recently, Philip, and Davros was another good one, but this one would be top of my list too, possibly because it was not overly complicated, but you've got that creepy voice that David Tennant puts on for Daft Jamie, which isn't quite as creepy when you listen to the whole thing, but in the trailer, it's very, very creepy. So I like that. But the story, how does that story...
Can I say, one of the good things about the trailer at this time too was these CDs always had the trailers coming up included. So modern productions, they don't put trailers for up-and-coming shows on them, but you had to listen to the trailers because they were put on. And I still listen to these old shows and hear the trailer coming and thinking, oh, I should go listen to that. So it was actually a good technique that made me listen to more.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, let's go to Mark then. Tell us about the story. How did this story stand up for you? It had been a while since you'd heard it.
It had been a while since I heard it. I remember getting it, obviously, originally on original release, so 2004. I've probably listened to this a couple of times because I did. I remember that it was the one when Leslie Phillips in. I forgot that that Daft Jamie was David Tennant. Forgot all that. So that was nice. And also, I didn't know whether I rated it that much because it didn't stand out in my head. But then when I listened to it the other day, I forgot how familiar I was with it. So I must have maybe listened to it two or three times in the past. But I've certainly not listened to it for a good, 15, 16 years or whatever. Blimey. So I did enjoy this one. Yeah, I thought the production values were great. I thought the acting was great. The script was great. It kept me engaged throughout as well, which is good. I mean, I knew that I would have to talk about it, so I thought I better really follow it. Because I think the problem is that I do a lot of my Big Finish listening when I'm driving. And obviously when you're driving, you're getting distracted all the time, aren't you? Thinking about, and it's so easy to fall out of the story and think, well, I ain't got a clue what's going on. And that's happened to me a lot in the past, and a lot of Big Finish where I just, it's finished and I've thought, well, I just didn't understand a word of that. But I didn't have that with this. I followed it. I made sure I was paying attention and I followed it all the way through. And yeah, I really enjoyed it. I thought it was a really interesting story. And the Burke and Hare thing was a, you know, quite a subject to deal with, isn't it, really? And the morality of what the doctor's trying to do as well. But I sort of wanted to shake their hands and be right pally with them, because he knows that what they're doing is going to benefit modern science and all this sort of ideas. Really straight. I don't know. It was a weird sort of thing, wasn't it? So I did enjoy all that dilemma as well. I did lose it slightly at the end with what was going on, even though I was trying to pay attention, because it wasn't all real, was it? It was in some sort of loop or something, wasn't it? Do you want to?
There was a few different threads going on there. A few different threads going on. Yeah. But firstly, on Burke and Hare, is that a familiar historical story for people in the UK? Because I didn't know much about it. Well, I did once I heard this.
I wouldn't say that I know much about it, but certainly the names that I knew, that there was two guys that went around getting dead bodies to experiment on for other people or whatever.
Is this case not well known in Australia, Philip?
No, it's not well known. I did some extra research for us just to, because I love a bit of true crime's fun, as I know you like too. So I certainly did a bit of extra research, but I didn't particularly know it before this story, or without this story, I wouldn't have known it.
Yeah. Okay. Well, as far as the convoluted nature of the story goes, I do understand that this was a very, very long, long script. It was one of Gary Russell's been quoted as saying this is the longest script he'd ever seen. So when it came to editing stage, he said that the episodes were about 90 minutes long. So yeah, when it was cut down, a lot of that story was cut as well, which made it possibly a little bit harder to follow. So, and there were quite a few different things going on within the story. I like the references to the Nekistani dealer on Griben, because that Nekistan,
part of the Gallifrey series.
That's right.
I didn't think it was that long ago since I listened to it, because I went through the whole Maggie Stables period. But now I'm thinking about it, it's probably 3 years ago. So it didn't stick out for my memory particularly through that run-through. There's other stories that, in my mind, I had preferred. But once it got started, I was actually in a good space, and it really quite freaked me out. There's a number of moments in which I thought, actually, this is really quite engaging. But one of the things that actually disturbed me slightly with it was, in fact, Colin Baker's reaction, the Doctor's reaction to Burke and Hare, because as a marketing,
it is unusual, isn't it?
It wasn't quite right. So it was an interesting characterization, because so much of what was happening was very realistic. So, Evelyn and the Doctor's relationship, their dialogue was really good. The acting, it's probably one of the best acted CDs I've heard for a very long time. There wasn't a single character that wasn't spot on in terms of tone, in terms of inclination, in terms of motive coming across through voice, in the creepiness. I was so blown away by every single actor in this. Usually there's one or two which aren't as strong. I couldn't find a weak one in this entire production. So the acting was superb. But I as I said, that characteristic of the Doctor, thinking that the end justifies the means, isn't a Doctor thing. The Doctor's never been one to believe the end justifies the means. As it's interesting, because I mean, I've got a bit of a love of history. Of course, you know, the Germans during the Second World War did horrendous experiments on the Jews and discovered all kinds of information about the human body, and they did shocking things in terms of brain experiments and, you know, putting, anyhow, all sorts of stuff. But when the Allies got hold of all that information, and there was document after document of amazing medical information through the torture of these prisoners, the Allies destroyed everything. Because the Allies said, we can't use information gathered in this way. The ethics behind it, the morality behind this is so horrendous that we will destroy all this information that had been gained through the murder of thousands of people rather than use it. So ethically, they said, we're not going to do this. And so in terms of, I just thought it was a bit unethical, the Doctor saying, well, actually, Burke and Hare murdering people so that they could experiment on the bodies and learn things to save life later, that's not the answer. And so, it did bother me how the Doctor was behaving in the first little while. Things improved once, and I had totally forgotten there was any time to travel, any spacey, racy things, since I actually thought it was going to be a pure historical. And, you know, I think I would have preferred it if it stayed as a pure historical. Yeah. Because those first two episodes were so fantastic and so wonderful. I don't think we needed the complication.
It got a bit busy, didn't it?
It got a bit too busy. I just don't think we needed that complication. I think the historical and having the Doctor in peril and trying to work out how to get out of this and recognizing that the dilemma for me should have been, I can't save Jamie. I can't save Mary. Fate is saying that they have to die, but how can I stay here and not leave? How, you know, so the morality may be staying and being as much comfort as he could be to them before history took them. I just thought there was other things they could have done because, as I said, the acting was superb, the storyline was superb. I learned so much about Burke and Hare. It made me investigate more, which all good Doctor Who does. I mean, my love for history comes from Doctor Who as a kid, that I'd see a Doctor Who show, I'd go off and study it. So there's really strong things in this. But, yeah, as I said, that one thing is what I would have tweaked about it. What about you, Dwayne?
And I have to stop myself saying Burke and Wills. So anyone in the UK, does everyone know Burke and Wills in the UK?
I think so.
Explorers?
Sorry.
So Burke and Wills were two Australian explorers who were the first white people to try and cross Australia from south to north. But they had no idea what they were doing. And thousands of Aboriginal people managed to survive in the desert for thousands of years, tens of thousands of years, but these white people wouldn't seek advice from anyone else, and in the end they died. So they managed to get to get to one side, but in trying to get back again, they didn't have enough supplies. And it was one of those tragic stories where there was they left a group of people behind with supplies who left the day before they arrived back, and in the end they died in the desert. But we Australians, we love the tragic stories where people just all die. We have lots like that.
Brilliant.
Just a little bit of trivia on Robert Ross. He's actually a comedy writer or a comedy historian. So interestingly, he's gone pretty straight and dark with this story. Although he does have a very famous comedy actor in the story. Oh, and I should mention that Leslie Phillips just passed away in the last month. So the Randomoid Selectatron must have known something about that film.
Yeah.
98 he was. 98.
Wow.
Interesting.
He was great in this as well, wasn't he? He was great. As Philip said, I agree that I think this is a beautifully acted piece. And I really noticed when I started listening to We Are the Daleks, no spoilers, but I noticed that was a lot more sort of stage and you could hear everyone acting in that. Whereas this was much more naturalistic. I don't know, it's just the characteristics, I think, it's just well played overall. And I mean, I love Colin Baker as the Doctor and Audie as well. I think he works so well. And Evelyn's brilliant. I mean, she's just, it's a great idea for a companion to have like an older woman. And
I was going to say, I miss Maggie Stables so much.
Yeah.
She was great.
This could have been played as melodrama. They didn't. They played naturalistically. And it made it all the more powerful because they did.
Yeah. I think I totally agree that I think that if they'd have just stuck with it being a purely historical, and not had any of that misty, different reality, time loopy thing in it, I think it'd have been a better story, to be honest, because it did start to lose me at the end, because it was just too many. It got messy, as Dwayne said, didn't it? It got messy. It's a shame.
Yeah, aliens and viruses and things. Okay, just the acting, I'll just point out Gary Russell directing, amazing job. And I don't think we give Gary anywhere near enough credit as a stunning director, because he was just pumping out every single, basically every single release he was pumping out for years. But when you can assemble a cast like this and get a performance like this out of people, that's the job of the director. So, Gary's done an amazing job.
Just on Robert Ross and his writing as well, did you know the story was originally supposed to be about Jack the Ripper rather than Burke and Hare?
Oh, really?
So that's an interesting bit of trivia. So the story was changed for that. Also,
do you know why? Why they chose not to use Jack the Ripper?
No, I don't. I don't. I just know that fact. I do know some facts. And I do have some notes from time to time, Philip.
There was a big, huge BBC production of Jack the Ripper that came out around this time.
Another one.
Oh, there's been so many, hasn't there?
Hmm.
But I do remember a fairly lavish production of Jack the Ripper coming out around this time, but I don't know what the BBC would have had you saying, don't do Jack the Ripper.
Well, they could have.
Could have done.
They could have. The other thing too, the character of Dr. Robert Knox, Leslie Phillips' character, that was originally supposed to be the Meddling Monk. So even back then, they were talking about bringing the Meddling Monk back, but it wasn't until 140 or something stories later, around closer to 200, when they brought Graham Garden back as the Meddling Monk. So this was where he was originally supposed to appear. Robert Ross did another two stories after this. He did one called Peer Pressure, which introduced another alien menace, which was not related to this story. But then in the third story, he brought Dr. Robert Knox and the alien from Peer Pressure together in a story called Assassin in the Limelight, which was another. They're all Sixth Doctor and Evelyn stories. So interesting trilogy. It's a trilogy before they were doing trilogies, wasn't it?
Is there actually an arc through them that you can notice?
Oh, yeah. Oh, I don't know about an arc between this and Peer Pressure, but there's definitely an arc between Peer Pressure and this and Assassin in the Limelight. They're connected in the third one.
Yeah, I must admit, I was thinking I need to go listen to them.
Even if it's just the characters, they're all connected. It's got the characters, the alien from Peer Pressure's in that with Robert Knox.
Yeah, I had a feeling Robert Knox appeared again, but I wasn't quite sure. There you go.
Hmm. Yep. Very good. Oh, what did we think of David Tennant in his early role in this? Mark?
Well, yeah, I mean, he put on a daft voice, didn't he? Oh, daft Jamie. But yeah, he was all right. You could tell it was him, couldn't you? It must be quite a difficult role to play that as well.
Here's a question. Would that be politically correct to have an actor of David Tennant's obvious talents playing handicapped person?
I don't know, you know. I think they might think twice about doing it now, you know. I think things have changed, haven't they, in a lot of ways. I don't know. That is a good question. I think they might think twice. But yeah, I don't know.
Or they get someone who's got cerebral palsy or something to play the character.
Well, maybe, yeah.
Who knows?
Yeah.
It was interesting. It crossed my mind once again listening to it in terms of representation for the disabled. But of course, you know, Daft Jamie's a real historical figure who was mentally challenged. So it's always hard to work out how you actually can portray that. But it did cross my mind listening to it that I was slightly uncomfortable because of how things have changed. But it was he's a historical figure and he had an important role to play. I think David Tennant did a superb job. And he would have been, you know, this is Tennant, very young and being pre-famous in any way, just loving to do anything Doctor Who. And he got to use his Scottish, which he doesn't get to do often.
Yeah. Absolutely. Even when he's not playing the Doctor in Big Finish, he still has to do his English accent in most of them, like Dalek Empire and Luther Arkwright.
Yep.
He is English in Luther Arkwright, isn't he?
Yeah. He is.
Pretty sure. Speaking of Maggie Stables, the timing has actually coincided with a Big Finish special. Can you believe it? Did you just notice that all the Evelyn Smythe stories have gone on sale up to the 6th of December? So you can grab them for up to 50% off from the Big Finish website. Anything with Evelyn in it. Very good. Any final thoughts on Medicinal Purposes, Philip?
It was much better than I expected it to be. My memory of it was that it wasn't that interesting. And when I listened to it again, I really was engaged the whole way through. So, yeah, I really enjoyed it.
Excellent. Mark?
Yeah, I'm going to echo Philip's statements, actually. I'm the same. When you said this is one of the stories we're going to do, I thought I don't have any strong memories about that, so it can't really have been that good a one. But when I listened to it, I thought, this is really good. I'm really enjoying it. And as I said, just slightly lost me towards the end. But apart from that, you know, it was a good one. It's a strong sort of 8 out of 10 for me because I like to score stuff. So, I enjoyed it.
Very good. All right, we're going to talk about our second story now that was randomly picked for us. We Are the Daleks, number 201 in the main range. I didn't mention at the outset, but I'm sure I'll put it in the show notes, that we are going to share with you a little chat that we had with the writer Jonathan Morris a couple of days ago. We're going to put that in too. and share that with you. He's got some interesting things to say about that particular story. But I will read a blurb for We Are the Daleks. The year is 1987 and Britain is divided. In Bradford, strikers are picketing and clashing with the police. In the city of London, stockbrokers are drinking champagne and politicians are courting the super rich. The mysterious media mogul, Alex Zenos, head of the Zenos Corporation, is offering Britain an economic miracle. His partners wish to invest, and their terms are too good to refuse. While the doctor investigates Warfleet, a new computer game craze that is sweeping the nation, Mel goes undercover to find out the truth about Zenos' partners. The Daleks have a new paradigm. They intend to conquer the universe using economic power. The power of the free market. Here's a trailer for that one.
Coming soon from Big Finish Productions. Doctor Who. We are the Daleks.
Threadneedle Street. City of London.
And the year?
1987.
1 year in my future.
I'd avoid bumping into anyone you know. But apart from that, you should find everything pretty much as you left it.
I wouldn't say that. Brinsley, what are you doing?
Nothing, Miss Bush.
Playing a computer game at work. I could have you fired.
Are you going to?
Ah, Mel. Sorry I'm late.
Doctor, what do you look like?
I'm blending in.
Blending in?
Ideal in futures.
What else?
So, Mel, anything else about this time that's different?
Well, there's Warfleet. That's new.
My name is Alec Zenos. I'm here as a representative of a foreign power.
What happened?
You've been transported across space-time.
So, where are we now?
Calico 9.
Allow me to introduce the Daleks.
They're called Daleks? Oh, how sweet.
Would you like some bonobons?
You're not the only one who wants to know what's going on in there.
Who are you?
Me? Oh, call me the Doctor.
It's no good! They've spotted us!
They must be exterminated!
Come on, you know the game's up! Exterminate!
I want to meet this emperor of yours.
What?
I haven't come all this way to speak with a monkey when I could be talking to the organ grinder.
Let me go, and I will let you live.
We have the power of life and death over you.
Very well. Don't say I didn't warn you.
Big Finish. We love stories.
Philip, hit us with your quick facts.
Facts and trivia. So, written by Jonathan Morris, number 201 in the monthly range. Recorded the 5th and 6th of January 2015 at the Moat Studios and released in July 2015. Starring Sylvester McCoy and Bonnie Langford. Bonnie last performed with Big Finish in 2012 and with Sylvester in 2006, so it's been almost 10 years since Sylvester and Bonnie performed together. Directed by Ken Bentley, producer David Richardson and Alan Barnes was script editor. This was the 11th time Wilfred Acosta did sound design and music.
And I noticed in the little blurb that I read that they used the phrase a new Dalek paradigm. So did they pinch that from the Matt Smith era, Mark? That phrase?
Maybe they did. They must have done. Probably. Let's hope they didn't pinch the Dalek design because they were terrible, weren't they?
Judging from the cover, they did not. It's got the Remembrance Daleks on the cover. So,
yeah,
that's a good thing. What were your impressions of this story? Good to get back to some Sylvester and Bonnie?
Yeah. I had no memory of this one. I had listened to it before. This is one I've got as a download, and I have listened to it before, but I had no memory of it, which usually means either one or two things. It either means it was no good or that I listened to it whilst I was driving and didn't understand it. So judged that it was no good. So listen to it this time. I really, really enjoyed it because I got right inside it. For the episode one, for the very first time, I've never done this before because I knew I was reviewing it. I thought, I'll have to, you know, make sure I follow this and get into it. So I listened to it in my studio where I am now with my lovely speakers and listened to it with my eyes closed and really got inside it. And I noticed that the sound design was absolutely amazing. When you listen to it properly, it's really incredible. And the whole story, I loved because the idea of, you know, what's going on now with the world, with the themes rang so true with Britain now in a lot of ways and the world now. It's sort of, it just really resonated. The same way in medicinal purposes resonated in the idea of the flu being like COVID sort of thing, this sort of it was weird how the two subject matters of these two stories were sort of really relevant for right now, even though they were done a while ago. So I really, really enjoyed this. I did notice at the beginning particularly that the acting was much more stilted and unnatural than Medicinal Purposes, but it's a different type of story. But I love the imagery of the office building being shaped like a Dalek. I thought that was great. And, you know, the Daleks going around serving, you know, cocktails or whatever. Would you like a shrimp or whatever they say? But, you know, I enjoyed all that side and yeah, followed it again. I made sure I followed this one all the way through and I thought it was really, really good with lots of nice twists. I love the twist of the guys playing the video games are really flying the Dalek drones and they're in a real war. I thought that was really good. And yeah, I just love the imagery. And so it was a really strong one. So I'm glad I give this another listen. And so, yeah, thanks for that, Duane, because without you, I wouldn't have listened to this back. And I really did enjoy it. Really, really, yeah, I loved it.
Yeah, it's fascinating for us too. We go back to some of these later main range stories. I think by the time, this is 201. So by the time it got to this, we were, I don't know, maybe I was taking for granted what we were getting month after month after month. And it was possibly becoming, you know, when Medicinal Purposes came out, I was still listening to them, you know, two or three times at least before the next one came out. At this stage, when We Are the Daleks, this is 2015. So not only do we have this, we've got other ranges, like was Torchwood out at that stage, Philip? I can't remember. Maybe it hadn't quite started yet, but there were other things that were getting released at the same time. And the monthly range was sort of becoming a little bit taken for granted by me anyway. And going back and revisiting these stories that I've only heard once before, in most cases, is a really, really pleasant surprise. But I just want to pick up on the fact that you said that this was a bit more stilted. And I think perhaps this is for the fact that it's more of an action. This is more of an action piece. And it's a lot busier than Medicinal Purpose, even though that got busy in the end. This is busy all the way through. But I did love the setting. 1987 was when I really had a big love affair with Doctor Who, and I was so heavily into my own personal fandom at that stage. I was soaking everything up that I could, and the new series. I was waiting for Sylvester and Bonnie's new series to come out, and you know, waiting there with my fingers on the record button. Mel gets to do some stuff with computers, which is great. She never got to do it on television, and it made me think of my personal computer. I had a PC in the 80s. It wasn't a Commodore 64. My parents were too cheap. I had a Sega SC-3000. But on the box, it said you could get this optional modem. And I always used to dream about getting this modem. And it was in the shape of a phone receiver. And you could plug the phone on the modem. I never had one. But I always wondered what it'd be like to be able to connect with other people on other SC-3000s. It would have been fantastic. Yeah. That's just some of my memories of 1987.
Well, I had an Apple IIe with a dot matrix printer.
Oh, that's fancy.
And so whenever group assignments had to be done, everyone came to my house because we could do it on the computer and print it out with a dot matrix printer.
How'd it go?
Was that right? Okay, 1987, it didn't feel like that to me. I really did not get the time period at all. It felt too advanced for that. So it was interesting that it was trying to be set in 87. It didn't feel like that at all. That's okay. I do agree with the acting. The acting was this was the melodrama. This was the characters playing over the tops. The two politician figures. So Celia Dunthorpe, played by Mary Conlan, and the older one, is it Robbie Stevens? I forget who the other politician was. Both of them tend to play a bit too dramatic. And then Angus Wright as Alex Zenos, who I actually really enjoyed. Actually, I enjoyed his performance. But once again, it was just slightly over the top evil. And then, of course, not evil as the story went on. And he died off too soon. Like he was actually the key character who they killed by the end of the third episode, which I was a bit surprised by because I thought he still had a lot more to do. So, yeah, I enjoyed it. I think there was, once again, a lot happening in the story. Bonnie, I love seeing how they've been using Bonnie better and better and improving Mel as a character, and they made her stronger. I did enjoy, to me, it was a lot more political satire than anything else. So it really was having a go at the political system. and not just the Great Britain, it's the political system around the world and how politicians deal and don't deal with things, and the expediency is more important than ethics was one of the big things coming up, which was just disappointing. But you know, as we currently have an ex-prime minister who's under investigation for taking on 58 different ministries during COVID secretly.
You're not exaggerating at all, are you?
No, it was five, wasn't it? Five or six ministries.
Five, I think.
Five secretly. I mean, what's going on there? So the fact that politicians behave in bizarre ways, it's only not just a British thing, it's an entire world thing. There's a lot in there to smile about.
He had as many portfolios secretly as the UK had prime ministers in 5 months.
Well, there you go. Different ways of doing things, I guess. one of the things I love about Doctor Who is it's able to be political subtly. So if we really wanted to examine this, we could pull apart a lot of stuff. And as Mark said, it actually is a piece of today with Brexit, with conservatism, with other things that are happening, the use of social media, use of media for popularity. It's actually a piece that's as relevant today as it was when it was written and would have been back then. It's a very powerful piece. And Doctor Who can be examined that way. It's one of the things I love about Doctor Who is it can be very subtle, but you don't have to do it. I think one of the things that I think bothered me most about the Chibnall era was if you wanted to make a point, he'd hit you over the head with it. So, the Green Death can teach people to be environmentally cautious without whacking you over the head like arachnids in the UK do. So, and this to me is a subtle satire on politics. You don't have to look at the politics. You don't have to look at the point that's being made. But if you want to dig a bit deeper, there's actually a lot in here. And, and once again, not knowing the political politicians, I do suspect a couple of people who are in here are representative of particular conservative politicians in the UK. I'm not quite sure who they'd be because, not being around there. But they actually felt like they had a lot of realistic traits that you could pick up. A bit like the Happiness Patrol was, very very obviously a takeoff of Maggie Thatcher. That's very much this era of Sylvester was pull down the structures of anarchy rules, pull down the structures of bureaucracy, and this story followed suit. So it had a lot of good things just going for it.
I agree that I didn't get a 1987 vibe from this either. I agree with you, Philip, that it felt much more like now with the technology and everything, just the whole setup. But that didn't sort of affect my enjoyment of it all. But I agree that it didn't, it didn't feel like 1987, even though it was great to have, as you said, Mel finally using a computer and using the computer skills. I think that's the first time I've ever heard using any of those traits at all.
Me with the 1987 vibe? I think it was the cover more than anything else, with that big Game Over logo on the front. So, plus it's got the Remembrance Dalek on the cover too. So that's very quintessentially late 80s. So that's, I guess that's what gave me the feel. I hear what you're saying though, because there are a lot of elements in there that can be applied to many different eras, particularly the political elements. But what do we think about things like the time corridors being used between Earth and Skaro, and we don't see that much. We don't see the Daleks doing that much.
No, I enjoyed that moment when they went through the time corridor and suddenly in Skaro. But it's like a utopian Skaro, isn't it? With like swimming pools and lush skylines and all this sort of thing. It was really interesting. That side, I thought, and it conveyed it well. I thought it was nice. And then the Thals turn up, and it's and just it gets very busy, but. I loved all that side. I thought that was great. And it was well put across sound design-wise as well, the way that they got that idea across. It's one of those things that if you're, for example, driving a car, listening to Big Finish, and you miss that moment where they go through the time, the sort of wormhole to another place, that you can suddenly be totally lost and think, I have no idea what's happening here. But in this particular time, I loved it, yeah.
I mean, the time channels are a useful device to move vast distances quickly, because you wouldn't want the travel of even just getting into the TARDIS, dematerializing, rematerializing, getting out, all takes time. Whereas the time channel travel allowed you tunnels allowed immediate transfer, and even at the point where as I said, the Celia Dunthorpe character was in an office in London, and then she wanted to go to another office, and so they just go through a time channel to get there. they don't even have to drive across London. They're just hopping backwards and forwards through wherever they need to be, as the most expedient time. So yeah, it was a convenient device to let them do things like that.
Chibnall used that a lot, didn't he? Chibnall in his scripts. Just sorry, going off subject here, but Chibnall always has people zipping in and out of places, and people with teleport belts and teleportation all the time. Drove me mad. Anyway, sorry, divergence there.
Yeah, but if you've got the Space Pirates, where every single journey takes a whole episode, that's the other extreme.
It's not that bad. I like the Space Pirates. Don't diss it.
It still does take entire episodes to get anywhere.
Yeah, but all that drama on the spaceships.
Yeah, standing in one room and discussing crates.
No, very
good.
I do still
want it back, though. Come back, Space Pirates.
Because the Time War aside, I mean, the Time War is the biggie, but we don't see the Daleks using time. We know that the Daleks have had time travel since the chase, haven't we? So we haven't seen them use it much before. A couple of early ones like Day of the Daleks and Evil of the Daleks, I kind of got a sense that this might have been close to Evil of the Daleks, like it could have even been some kind of a sequel. Did you get that impression, or was I just imagining it?
There was certainly at one point where the Daleks said, "Do not fight in here," just exactly like the Evil of Daleks.
So a little reference. Quite a lot of,
the Emperor. There was lots of nods to lots of Dalek shows. Yeah. And even to the Victory of the Daleks with Daleks serving Trey. So I think Jonathan Morris is doing lots of nods to lots and lots of different Dalek shows.
Montage.
But done in reverence, and so it's okay. I mean, there's lots of very amusing moments. I went, oh, hang on, that's that, and that's that. I'm not sure if this is one of the first times, but it's just starting to see Nick Briggs with his range of characters playing backwards and forwards of himself.
There was a big range, wasn't there?
There's a big range. And nowadays, I mean, I forget which one. There was one of the...
It was a Time Lord Victorious.
Time Lord Victorious, which he was just amazing in playing, all these different characters, so different, so diverse, having conversations with himself with these different characters. And this actually is a fairly early example of him playing several different types of Daleks, as opposed to all the same Dalek voice, but these are very different Daleks having different motivations, different voices, and Nick really getting into his stride as an amazing Dalek artist.
Yeah,
and so this was number 201. It was touted as being a jumping on point for new people coming into Big Finish. So, do you think that worked, Philip? I guess with the Daleks there, that's always a draw card.
Yeah, it's a great epic story to kick it off, and it's got everything that you'd want for kicking off story. It has got a bit of a vibe of Remembrance of the Daleks, but of course that's the '60s. The 25th season kicked off with a big Dalek story. Lots of action. This has similar ideas of lots of actions. Planet Scarrow. It's interesting that here the Doctor's basically destroying Scarrow, and he'll very soon he'll go and do it again, but wipe him out properly. So he really, he's a bit of a vengeful so-and-so when it comes to Scarrow.
He is. But this is when the Doctor's, he's sort of getting his darker self, the Seventh Doctor, at this point when he's with Mel, isn't he? He sort of gets darker and darker as this incarnation goes on. So it's a very interesting character, the Seventh Doctor. He changes a lot throughout his time, doesn't he?
Yeah, it's great. I enjoyed him at the time, Sylvester, and I still think he's a wonderful Doctor. And they all are, aren't they? They all are, apart from maybe, no, I won't say.
I think we know. All right. Any final thoughts on We Are the Daleks? Did we miss anything before we jump to our chat with Jonathan Morris?
Oh, let's hear what Jonathan has to say.
Okay. Stick around, Mark. We'll be back in a second after we have a little chat with Jonathan.
You are now travelling through time and space.
So once again, thank you so much, Johnny Morris, for joining us, the author of Doctor Who, We Are the Daleks. Johnny, do you want to tell us how did you come up with this idea? How did it come about?
As I remember, there are three elements to it that sort of popped into my head, which I combined. One, which is the idea of a sort of a skyscraper in the centre of London that looked like a Dalek, which I think was inspired by going on a train through Leeds, where they do have a skyscraper that looks just like a Dalek, and that's the one that ended up on the front of the CD, on the cover. So I thought that would just be a great hook for the story to go, okay, why is there a building that looks like a Dalek? Because a couple of years later, they finished the Shard in London, and when that was lit up for the first time, people go, there's a Dalek in the middle of London, a giant Dalek. So I thought that was an interesting hook. And then I don't know if political is the right word, but there was the idea that lots of governments around that time, including our own, were telling us that the future would involve us having more economic ties with countries that had an appalling human rights record, or which had no equality, or which persecuted minorities, or which invaded other countries, you know, places like China and Russia and so on. And you know, the whole issue now, of course, with the World Cup being in Dubai, it's the same sort of thing. And I just thought, okay, let's do a Doctor Who version of that. Let's do a story where the government of the day says we now have to cozy up to the worst regime in the universe. Again, we have to make economic links with the Daleks, because the Daleks are offering us economic prosperity. And no matter how evil they are, no matter how, you know, how many people they exterminate, we'll put that down to Dalek culture, cultural differences, because of the economic argument trumps everything. And that was certainly something that was going around in 2014. And it remains sort of relevant today, because I think various people have realized what a mistake they made back then.
So even though this story has, well, it's set in the Thatcher era and there's a Thatcher-like character in there, you're not specifically dealing with that particular political era, are you? It's more current to the time you're writing it. Is that right?
There's elements of it today, just because I forgot the third idea. Can I go back to the third idea, which was just the idea that when kids are playing computer games, that the computer game is actually real. People said was from Ender's Game, which I hadn't read at the time, because it goes back way beyond that. It goes back to things like Tron and The Last Starfighter. And one of the stories in Peter Davison's book of Alien Monsters is about that. And there's a
Terry
Terry Pratchett novel as well, which is Only You Can Save Mankind. So that's why I didn't use it as the main hook of the story, because I thought, I'm a bit embarrassed by this. It's a bit old hat. The other aspect, which ties in with the 80s aspect, was that I'd done sort of Doctor Who stories going, sort of like nostalgia ones where you're trying to recapture the feel of the old TV show. But for this, I was going, okay, it's the 1980s. What else was going on around then? And you had alternative comedy. You had things like The New Statesman. You had the Comic Strip Presents, doing things like GLC, and you had these sort of slightly dark sitcoms like A Small Problem and Citizen Dad and Upstairs and Ladders. These might mean nothing to you, but that was the sort of scene where I was sort of going, okay, what would Doctor Who have been like if it had been written by the team behind the comic strip? You know, the people who, if it had been written by Ben Elton, for instance. So that's where the tone and the politics came from. But it wasn't about Mrs. Thatch, partly because I don't think that would represent her views. I don't think she was very keen on cozying up to dictators. All credit to her, that's not something I would accuse her of. Because actually that character was, I mean, it's most 99% fictional. I made up, but there was a backbench Conservative MP in the 90s called Theresa Gorman, who at the time was a sort of what we'd now call a sort of a Brexiteer, which is now sort of obviously the political mainstream in the UK. But at the time, she was like a nutcase, and everyone regarded her quite rightly as a fringe, on the lunatic fringe of the Conservative Party. But I you know, because she was trying to bring down John Major's government. That's how nutty they were. And so I thought, so that character has elements of Teresa Gorman, which is fine because she's dead. She can't sue. And at the time, I thought she was entertaining. I didn't see the harm in what she was saying.
What about the title? How does that relate to the Daleks and the nature of humans to you?
I think it's actually just the fundamental idea that everything the Daleks represent. I think I might have written this in a Doctor Who magazine article around the same time. I don't know. Right from the beginning, the Daleks have represented not alien monsters from outer space, bug-eyed monsters. They have represented some of the worst traits in humanity. I mean, the most obvious one is they have no empathy. They regard things they disagree with as being less than them and disposable. You know, they have a dislike of the unlike. And then you have the whole thing of them being very, having similar traits to the Nazis and being sort of devious and duplicitous and militaristic. But it generally just comes down to, this is what happens to people when you have a tyrannical regime, that it turns people into Daleks. And so one of the big points of the story, I think, is a scene, I think it's in part four, where there's a radio station based in a tower in London, which is broadcasting propaganda, which is making people more hateful. It's just taking away their empathy. It's making them more bigoted, you know, against foreigners, against freeloaders, about, you know, the unemployed, about asylum seekers. That all got toned down a lot during rewrites. But the idea was, okay, this is like those TV stations and radio stations that broadcast stuff, which makes the people listening or watching less human. It makes them less tolerant. And it's not just one TV station or radio station or one newspaper. It's a whole sort of machine. And the idea that you could twist a nation's psyche just by broadcasting stuff, you just think, oh, the Daleks would use that, because that's quick and easy. That's already using part of human nature against them. I think I wrote it as a sort of a call-in show to a radio station where someone's going, you know, Jeff, you know what I think they should do to these asylum seekers? I think they should be exterminated. I think we should get a gun, line up against the wall, and exterminate them. And that all got toned down, but as you can see...
I can see why.
the idea is that caller into that radio station is now talking like a Dalek. He's lost something which is human because of the hatred that's been purveyed by these sort of organizations.
And even though it's set in 1987, these are still issues that continue right through to today in things like social media and other kinds of media, shall we say.
Yes. I mean, although it's set in 1987, generally just because of Doctor Who continuity, that was the 1987 era of the Seventh Doctor and Mel. It was written in 2014, and it's about stuff which is as relevant now as it was then, as it was in the 80s. It comes around, you know, things like in America, things like Fox News and Alex Jones with his and stuff. It's every 10 years you think it goes away, but then it comes back. And things like social media, things like, you know, Twitter and stuff, it's the same sort of thing. It's these sort of mechanisms rise up to sort of make people less. And I think in 2014, there was a definite feeling that parts of the media were turning the British population, who had at that point had no particular feelings about Europe and had no particular feelings about immigration. And it was just sort of poking away at them, going, you should hate immigrants. You should hate the EU. And that was a little drumbeat in the background. You know, that's what I was thinking I was picking up then. But because it's a Doctor Who story and it's a licensed stuff, obviously it has to be toned down and made into a fun story about Daleks.
what do you think is the place of politics in Doctor Who? Because Doctor Who's always been political. What do you think is the role of politics?
I wouldn't say Doctor Who's always been political. I think that's something that people would like to overstate. Well, it depends what you mean by political, because political is, it's always been political, but it's not been left or right. It's been about power structures. It's been about authority. I mean, the classic example is the Sunmakers, which, depending on who's just written the review, is either a satire of capitalism or it's a satire of socialism. It works for both of them because it's actually about a power structure. It's about bureaucracy. It's about the little guy being oppressed by. So in a way, that's very basic politics. You know, the businessman in the suit and tie is the baddie. And generally, I don't think Doctor Who's politics have ever been more sophisticated than that. I mean, things like the Green Death is still the businessman with the suit and tie is the baddie. But I think writing the story like We Are the Daleks and stuff, I think it's just important for the story to be about something, to have a point, a theme, but something where you have a, you've been given this opportunity to tell a story which other people are going to listen to. So put a bit of meat on the bone as well, you know, so it has a point. So people don't have to agree with it. People can vehemently disagree with it. But I think all sort of fiction should have a point. And that can be a political point, but it can also be a philosophical point. It can be an autobiographical point. It could be, it can be educational, but it should have something, an extra sort of reason to exist, not just being entertainment for its own sake.
In your notes, you talk about this being satire. Once again, where do you think the role of satire fits? And how do you know when satire is being effective?
Satire is famously ineffective. I don't think satire has ever worked, really. It's almost like it's been regarded as a safety valve, that if you mock the people in charge, they stay in charge. If they, like I said, satire is another thing. It's another thing that Doctor Who can do. I don't think it's ever done it particularly well, but there's a difference between satire and topical humour, because they're making jokes about what happened in the news in the last week, which I would say is topical jokes. They're not really satire. Satire is pointing out hypocrisies and pointing out parts of human nature that are stupid. The classic example being, in Gulliver's Travels, we have two societies at war and absolutely hating each other because they eat boiled eggs in different ways. And you go, Jonathan Swift has gone, that is why people hate each other. It's for stupid reasons, because we're exactly the same. And if you're a big person looking down on them, you go, why on earth are you fighting about something so trivial? And that's what satire, I think, she does. It gives you a different perspective. It makes things bigger or smaller, or it gives them historical dressings or science fiction dressings. So you can see yourself reflected in a sort of distorting mirror, which is actually a magnifying glass and lets you see things more clearly.
So this release was designed to be a new jumping on point for Big Finish listeners. So I guess it's quite an honour that they picked you and decided we'll start with a big epic Dalek story. Is there anything you do different now if you were writing it?
I don't know if that was part of the brief. It might have been, because it's number 200, isn't it? It's got a round number.
It's 201.
201, 201. Yeah, I didn't get to do 200. With some stories, you try and write them as though they're pastiches of Doctor Who in the 60s or 70s and 80s. And sometimes you go, I'll write Doctor Who as it is now. And We Are the Daleks was me writing Doctor Who as it was in 2014. It's like me writing a contemporary Doctor Who story. It wasn't me pastiching, the Andrew Cartmell era. So I think that's the sort of a reason why it's a good jumping on point, because it's just, and also because it, although it has the Daleks in it, it has no previous continuity because there's no point. The moment you start referring back to stuff or referring to other stories, you know you're going to get it wrong because it's complicated and it's contradictory. So the best thing is just to go, okay, I'll just keep it simple and straightforward and just refer to stuff that's been on television because I think it slots in between Revelation of the Daleks and Remembrance quite well because it sort of follows on from one and sets up the other. Jumping on point? That's a marketing question. I don't know.
I suspect because the trilogies were so continuity heavy up to number 200, it was probably Alan Barnes who made that conscious decision to make more standalone episodes rather than, they were still trilogies, but the stories were a lot more self-contained from your story onwards. And I think that was a conscious decision so people didn't have to get so bogged down with the trilogies.
I'm nodding along with what you say. I think I'd forgotten. Yes, the trilogies had been a approach then, which I think was the right thing to do. And it's very similar to what they do now with box sets, to be honest, because you want each person who buys a story to buy another one. And linking them together in different ways is a way of doing that. I don't know if I'd ever use the phrase bogged down. I mean, what always happened, people go, I quite like the sound of number two in the trilogy, or I quite like the sound of number three, but I don't like the sound of number one, so I'm a bit stuck. I won't buy any of them. And you want to sort of re-emphasize going, you don't have to have bought all of them to understand them. You can just buy number two or number three because the people making them don't necessarily know what happens in the stories either. They're all sort of self-contained in the way they're made anyway. You need to change the situation every now and then. You know, things do get stuck in a rut.
When you were approached by David Richardson to do this, were you given Sylvester and given Bonnie and then asked to pitch ideas? How were you approached?
My memory is that I was told Sylvester and I asked to do a Mel story because I'd done one a long, long time ago, another sort of political satire called Flip Flop, which I thought I was a mixed bag, a curate's egg, you know, and I wanted to have another go at getting it right and writing a story which couldn't be taken the wrong way, where people would come away from it going, I get what Johnny's point is with this, that the Daleks are the bad guys and we should not cozy up to awful regimes. I wanted that sort of message to come through fairly unambiguously. You know, there's no nuance in it. When I'd written Flip Flop, I'd been doing it as a sort of pastiche of Pip and Jane Baker dialogue, or, you know, so people listening to it go, Johnny can't write dialogue to save his life. It's really clunky. And I'm going, no, it's deliberately clunky. It's authentically clunky, you know, with other Daleks.
I loved Flip Flop. Still one of my faves.
I know, but it does have these ridiculous, I gave Bonnie Langford these ridiculous lines, knowing they were authentic to, you know, to time in the Rani and stuff. With the Daleks, I went the other way. I'm just going to write Mel realistically. I'm going to write her as a proper character and give Bonnie Langford proper stuff to act rather than...
And stuff to do with computers.
And stuff to do with computers. But just trying to give a proper dramatic scene. So it's not me being, I don't know if, I wouldn't say it was disrespectful, but, you know, just getting her to reprise her performance from the 1980s is a bit sort of unambitious and a bit of a, if you've got that an actor that good in the studio for 2 days, you want to use them. You don't want to just be repeating themselves. So you want them to stretch themselves. You want them to feel like they're doing good work and doing stuff they haven't done before. So that's why I selected Mel. And I think I'd done two or three ace stories before that, so I wanted a bit of a change.
Well, listen, Johnny, thank you so much for your time again and some extra insights. We really appreciate hearing what you had to say, and we've learned a lot, so thank you again.
Cheers, thanks. It's nice talking to you.
You're listening to the Sirens of Audio podcast, where Big Finish and Doctor Who chat collide.
All right. So thank you, Jonathan Morris, for spending some time with us to talk about We Are the Daleks. Always good to chat with Jonathan, Philip. He's always happy to chat with us too, so that's good.
I know, and he's in the middle of writing a huge book at the moment. He was prepared to give us... I asked for 15 minutes, he gave us half an hour. He can't help himself. But it's always good to have a yarn with him.
He can't help himself, Philip. Is that what you're saying?
No, he can't help himself. He just loves to talk to us.
Neither can you. No, neither can you.
I can't shut up either.
All right. That only leaves us two things. The first thing is we need to pick the next two stories for what we like to call...
We've Got Randomoids.
What? You'll be muted there. All right, let me just bring it up. I'll have a look. Oh, here we go. All right, so, Philip, you're going to like this one. It is Fourth Doctor Adventures number 3.2, White Ghosts, written by Alan Barnes, starring Tom Baker and Louise Jameson.
I don't remember it off the top of my head, but that's fantastic.
Yeah, excellent. So... I can't remember when we've done an Alan Barnes story previously. We probably have, but...
I don't remember doing a Tom Baker.
We've done Tom Bakers.
Okay.
Oh, well, there's an interesting one. Very close to the one we've just done. We might go for it, eh? This is a Fifth Doctor adventure starring Peter Davison, Nicola Bryant, Carolyn Morris as RMM, The Axis of Insanity.
Oh, okay.
Oh, you're hesitating at that one.
Oh, I don't think I like it, but we'll see. It's been a while since we listened to it.
Isn't this the same axis that appears in the Benny stories?
No, it's not.
Different axis altogether?
Yeah, it's if it's the one I think it is, it's kind of a bit of a dream world with a sort of clowny character. It's all a bit sort of silly and... Yeah, anyhow, we'll see. It may not be what I'm thinking it is. But I've got this vague feeling it's like a clown character in it, and it's all a bit World of Fiction-ish.
Yes, it is. It is. But
that is the one. Okay. Well, that's good.
We've got to do it. We've got to do it.
I love Caroline Morris, so I don't mind.
So that'll be our first Randomoids episode for 23. There you go. All right. We've got to do some recommendations of things to listen to, and I'm not going to recommend anything this time because... I'll tell you why in a second. But Philip, I think, according to my notes, you're the one that's got to go first.
Okay. I'm going to recommend a podcast, which is both, I think, on video. Actually, it's definitely on YouTube, as well as podcast, called The Review of Death. I came across this YouTube, actually, because I've started getting back into my character options figures, and I've been unpackaging all my boxed up Doctor Who figures and TARDISes and things and putting them on display because I got a office finally. I had a son move out and got his bedroom. Fantastic. So I found this YouTube video called The Review of Death, and they unpackage and discuss the character options figures as they come out. And so, yeah, it's been really engaging. I've loved how they've been doing that. But as well as the fact that they do these character options reviews, they also do the reviews of the shows. And so it's just a couple of guys. I can't even tell you what their names are. I've only watched a few episodes. I've watched all their character option shows, and I've listened to a few episodes. It pulls it about once a month. They give some news and other stuff. I've been enjoying it. That's my the review of death. It's called stupid name, but that's part of the whole point. Whoa. That was it.
Okay. So as I said, I'm not going to review anything, but I have a sneaky suspicion that having Mark Atkinson on the show, he's got something that he might want to recommend that's very close to his heart.
Oh, my own music. Thanks to him. Set me up there. I just want to say I listened to the Review of Death as well. It's pretty good. But anyway, I'm a musician. So I have solo albums out under my own name, Mark Atkinson. That's Mark with a C. I'm in two bands. One's called River Sea and the other band is called Moon Halo, which is my more recent things. We've got a couple of albums out with Moon Halo and a couple out with River Sea as well. So if you want to check them out on YouTube, that'd be great. And if you like what you hear, just get in touch by my website or whatever. And lovely. Thank you.
Can I throw in one of your tracks here?
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
Yeah, I was looking through my phone today and I've got one of your albums on there. From years ago. Lovely. It's called Black and White.
Oh, okay. Lockdown album.
Was that your lockdown album, was it?
Yeah, Black and White's my album. Yeah, it's the one I did to keep me afloat. So as soon as we went into lockdown, I wrote it, yeah.
Ah, cool. But you do a version of a Peter Gabriel song on there that I listened to today that I really enjoyed, and that's Sledgehammer. Did you ever listen to that?
Not really. Okay, if you want.
You could have a steam train if you just laid down your tracks. You could have an aeroplane flying if you bring your blue skies back. All you do is call me, I'll be anything you need. You could have a Big Dipper going up and down around the bends. You could have a bumper car bumping. This amusement never ends. I wanna be your sledgehammer. Why don't you call my name and let me be your sledgehammer? This will be my testimony, yeah. Show me around your fruitcakes, 'cause I will be your honeybee. Open up your fruitcakes, where the fruit there is sweet as candy. I wanna be your sledgehammer. Why don't you call my name and let me be sledgehammer? Put your mind at rest, I'm gonna be your sledgehammer. This can be my testimony, your sledgehammer. Let there be no doubt about it, sledge, sledge, sledgehammer. I kick the habit, kick the habit, kick the habit. Shed my skin, shed my skin. This is the new stuff, this is the new stuff. I'll go dancing in, cause I wanna be the sledgehammer.
All right, thank you very much for joining us, Mark. It's been great to have you.
Oh, thank you. It's been nice to do a podcast again for the first time.
Yeah, thanks, Mark. It's been great.
Cheers, Philip. I enjoyed it. Thank you.
I wonder if it's whetted your appetite to do some more.
Well, we'll have to see what this next year brings.
It's a big year. Big year coming up too.
It is. And yes, I've got plans, but I'll say no more for now. See what happens.
With a very curious stroking of the beard. Yeah. Stay tuned. All right. Thanks a lot, Mark. And Philip, you know I love you too.
Oh, it's been wonderful, Dwayne.
Oh, thank you so much. This is actually the last show we're recording for 23. We've got another one coming out next week, so make sure you stay tuned for that. We're doing a special retrospective on Sarah Jane Smith Series 1 because it's been 20 years since that was released. So we're going to be speaking with Gary Russell. We're going to be speaking with Jez Fielder, Peter Angelides, David Bishop. So they're all the people who were involved that we could get hold of. We're going to throw in some archive footage that we had with Sadie Miller talking about that as well. So stick around. That'll be our final official episode for 2023 next time, and then we'll be taking a little break. So we might throw in some bonus stuff throughout the next few weeks, but we'll be back with our 2022 review show with Kenny Smith in early January. So good stuff. Thank you, Philip. Thank you, Mark. We'll catch you all next time. This has been the Sirens of Audio episode 136, Randomoid 16, featuring the story's medicinal purposes, and We Are the Daleks with our guests Mark Atkinson and Jonathan Morris, with your hosts Philip Edney and Dwayne Bunny. Original theme music composed by Joe Kramer. Our website is sirensofaudio.com. Our email address is sirensofaudio@gmail.com, or you can get in touch via any one of our socials. Thanks for listening, audiophiles. We'll hear you next time.